morning.
We welcome today the Wisconsin Career Academy. Would those students please stand? They may come. Randolph High School. You please stand. Thank you very much for coming. We're delighted to see you. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar. We invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. If the students arrive and agree to come, they are given materials relating to this case and may engage in some activities in the school about the case. They come, listen to oral argument, and then at lunchtime, after the second oral argument, the students will meet with a justice who is assigned for that day. And the discussion is on the procedures of the court in accepting and hearing cases and deciding cases, not the substantive issues. Everyone is invited to join the students after the second case. So let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. You will meet with Justice Robensack after the second case. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case, which is 09-AP-688. Susan Foley, is it Ciccantelli?
Ciccantelli.
Versus Bishop's Grove Condominium Association, Inc. Let me go through the lineup first. 20 minutes for Mr. Endringa, representing the plaintiff. 5 minutes to John Ebbett, who is filed an amicus brief and to whom 5 minutes has been ceded. 30 minutes to Neil Schellinger, representing the defendant, and 5 more minutes to you, Mr. Endringa, in rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Attorney Schellinger and Attorney Ebbett. Thank you very much for taking this matter before the court. My name, again, is Attorney Timothy J. Andringa. I am with the law firm of Kramer, Maltoff, and Hammes, LLP, in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Our office represents the plaintiffs in this matter, Susan and Dr. Mark Foley-Ciccantelli. The matter before the court is on certification from District 2 Court of Appeals. The issue is, can a circuit court disqualify counsel in a civil case, thereby denying the clients their right of representation by chosen counsel and restricting the practice of law by its chosen counsel where the law firm previously represented a witness or a proposed witness in the case? Judge Foster ruled that because of the appearance of impropriety, and I would cite to the court her decision, it's R31, the record 31, in pages 3, 5, and 7, and 8. That appears to be the only standard that the circuit court used, and it's our position that the circuit court erred in concluding that our firm should be disqualified. I would briefly, and I would say briefly, like to review just some of the more pertinent facts. I think it'll take about 90 seconds to do that led us here today. Number one, on February 1st.
Counsel, let me interrupt for just a minute. Since you've raised the issue of the standard utilized by the circuit judge, it's my understanding that that standard was the appearance of impropriety. Is that correct?
Yes. That's what I believe the circuit court, in her decision, basically that was her conclusion.
And you're saying she didn't discuss any other doctrines or approaches to this particular issue other than the appearance of impropriety?
That is what the trial court focused on, and I believe that is what her decision focuses on, yes.
Thank you.
On February 1st, 2007, Mrs. Foley Cicintelli and Dr. Cicintelli purchased a condominium at Bishop's Grove. They purchased unit 175C. They did not move in that day. On February 6, 2007, they had a painter at their unit, and she went and visited her unit to view the painter's work, and she slipped and fell in what I believe is a common area or limited common area as a result of a gutter leaking causing an unusual amount of ice that she slipped and fell on and suffered a very severe fracture dislocation to her foot.
Is the issue of whether it's a common area a significant one in the case?
It is and it isn't, in that, as you will find out, one of the things that the circuit court focused on was my discussions with the property manager.
Can you win if it's not a common area?
Can I win if it's not a common area? No. If she had fallen on her private property, there's no claim.
Okay. So whether it's a common area is a significant issue.
It is a significant.
Okay.
Yes.
Who takes care of this common area?
Correct. The association is responsible for it.
The association. Who takes care of it for the association?
The association has delegated that to a management company.
When you say delegated,
they've contracted.
Contracted. Is Bishop Grove liable for the acts of the management company?
In my opinion, absolutely. They're the only ones that are responsible for it.
Well, isn't the management company responsible for it?
The management company is not responsible to my client for it. The management company is responsible to the association for it.
Why isn't it responsible to your client?
Because they are not the owner of the property. They merely oversee and management at the direction of, or potentially at the direction of, the association. It's a non-delegatable duty.
I know, but if they're negligent, suppose they dumped ice there, negligently dumped ice, wouldn't they be liable?
So, Your Honor, I believe my only claim lies with the association, and then the association has the right, if they so choose, to seek indemnification or contribution for their actions.
But the injured party has no direct action against the management company, in your view, for a negligent act of the management company.
That is correct. The duty does not come from the management company back to my client. It solely comes from the association.
Duty only comes because of that contract and not because of a negligent act. That's
correct.
What you're saying. Negligent act doesn't arise a duty.
Correct.
Duty doesn't arise. Okay. All right.
Under the policy of insurance with State Farm, however, it appears as though the management company is an insured under that policy. What, if any, import is that in your analysis?
I don't believe it has any import with respect to this analysis. However, obviously it restricts, in my opinion, the association's ability to seek indemnification or contribution because they chose to allow them to be an additional insured. Now, that kind of gets me to why the facts somewhat get important, because what the trial court focused on appeared to be the impropriety of my firm having contact with the management company as being, quote, a client of Attorney Schellinger. And that was not presented or known to our office that was the position they were taking until oral argument at the trial court level. And actually, that kind of gets me into this analysis of the facts as to why I believe the facts are somewhat important with respect to this situation.
So is that their argument, that you talked to someone who was represented by them, or an employee or an agent of someone who's represented them, therefore you should have been talking to Mr. Schellinger and not to Mr. Foster? Is that the argument?
It was an important factor that the trial court focused on in its decision to disqualify our firm.
Was that the argument up here, too?
I believe that is a significant factor. That's the facts that they keep relying on and keep stating, and that's why in the Court of Appeals reply brief I pointed out the sequencing of that contact is important. And I point out in my appellate reply brief that the sequencing that has been pointed out by the defendants is not the sequence as to what occurred with the events. Put it this way. I would not, if Attorney Schellinger in July. When I wrote him my letter in July 2008, after he wrote a letter to me saying, don't have contact with my client, I replied back, I have not had any contact with your client. The clients at that time that I understood he was referencing were the defendants in this case, Bishop's Grove and State Farm. And I clearly pointed out in my letter, I don't know what you're talking about. Certainly, he can't restrict my client's right to have contact with his clients. She lives in a condominium complex. She has to have contact with the management company. It's impossible not to.
Do you think that communication, however, plays any role in the substantial relationship test?
I believe the trial court, I don't believe, applied the substantial relationship test. It just gave her the appearance of impropriety. And that's what she relied upon.
It's a bare bones decision. That's clear.
I don't believe it does. It has nothing to do with the substantial similarities. None. My contact had nothing to do with... it's quite clear in the record. Attorney Peter Plowshines was the attorney at our firm that had prior representation of the Foster Group in unrelated matters. When I ran my conflicts check, it didn't come up because I wasn't suing the Foster Group. I didn't recognize Wayne Foster or the Foster Group to be a client of our firm. So I certainly have no relationship with Wayne Foster. I didn't know him from a stranger on the street. I've never met Wayne Foster.
Did you know that the Foster Group, at the time you called him, was the managing agent for the condominium association?
I did, for two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, as I pointed out in my affidavit on the record, I was president of my condo association. I've represented condo developers. I'm aware that many condominium developments either manage the property themselves, hire an employee to manage, or manage through management companies. My client informed me, as a result of my indication that the State Farm adjuster said she fell on private property, she doesn't understand condominium law, I was told about the existence of the management company and that the management company may be able to set her straight on why the limited common areas or common areas are not the property owned by the unit owner, but are owned and managed by the association. So, yes, I did.
What did you allege as the negligence of Bishop's Grove?
Very simply, Your Honor, what occurred here, the reason why the water accumulated in this area on the driveway where nobody would have expected it because the downspout is farther down the driveway, the gutter was rusting out. It's what we call pitted. As a matter of fact, I have deposed the people that the management company hired to replace some gutters because of this same problem. And what happened was that as the frost or snow melted on the roof, it came into the gutter, it dropped through the gutter, landed on a shaded portion of the driveway area here, froze, there was a light dusting of snow, my client slipped on it. And our position is this is not a natural accumulation, and had the gutter been properly maintained and replaced in a timely fashion, she would not have slipped and fallen in this area.
I think I understand that. But what did the association do that was negligent?
The association should have taken that gutter off well prior to. As a matter of fact, the photographs that we would introduce into evidence show that this area where this unnatural accumulation of ice occurred was rusted, meaning that it had existed there long enough to show a rust stain on the driveway area. And what's important is my client hadn't even moved into the premises or into her unit, so she wouldn't have had any notice or knowledge to report it. But the association, number one, had been replacing gutters elsewhere in the community, and obviously, if you looked at this gutter, and we preserved it for evidence, it's severely pitted. And I believe that there's sufficient enough, if not actual, constructive knowledge of this condition. And the association should have replaced that gutter.
Were these gutters the original gutters?
I don't know that. I believe so.
Well, who was responsible for putting in the original gutters?
Well, probably the real estate, the developer.
And the developer was?
I believe I'm not sure. Every developer forms an entity to develop a specific piece of property. I don't know if it was I don't know if it was Foster Group in association with someone else. I can tell you this. The association and apparently this development has always been represented by the Reinhardt Berner firm. As a matter of fact, 2 years prior to this incident, as I submitted in my affidavit, they were making amendments indicating that they represented still Bishop's Grove.
What I'm really trying to get at with my line of questioning, and you are personally head of a condominium association, or were in the past.
Right.
Do the officers of the association, or does the association itself go and fix the gutters, or do they delegate that to somebody else?
Oftentimes what will happen is the board of directors, when something is raised to them, will act upon it. But the board of directors basically is responsible for maintaining and making sure that the common areas, the roofs, if it's time to paint units, stuff like this, since you live there oftentimes, or it's a requirement that you live there, you're kind of knowledgeable as to what needs to be done and when it needs to be done. So the board of directors heads up the association and ultimately makes those decisions, and then I would assume would tell the management company, we want the gutters replaced, or we want you to inspect the gutters, determine which ones, and come back with a recommendation, or we've received a complaint, please take care of this.
So the management company doesn't act without the direction of the board of directors?
Oftentimes, that's correct. I mean, certainly if the management company is doing the snow plowing and they damage something, or the management company becomes aware of something, they might bring it to the attention of the board. But the board makes the ultimate decision.
Is the management contract in this record?
Yes, it is. Trying to move on somewhat to these facts, it is important that the court realize that I received a request for admissions of the policy that the court was referencing earlier. In it, there was no request for me to admit that Foster Group was an additional insured, and therefore nothing indicated that they were the client that Attorney Schellinger was referencing later in his July letter that I shouldn't have contact with. Obviously, once I'm informed by an attorney that I should not have contact with a client, ethically I'm responsible to make sure that I don't. My July 28th letter in reply to his letter says, I don't know what you're talking about, and I didn't. Not until the dots were connected at oral argument. Attorney Schellinger could have contacted me back in July when I invited him to call me if he was referencing the management company that somehow I was having contact with, which I clearly hadn't. Once the lawsuit was filed, I had no further contact with Mr. Foster until scheduling his deposition, because I understood that he was merely a witness in the case, not a party, and I did not understand that Attorney Schellinger was arguing that he was his client that I wasn't supposed to have contact with. And as the trial court even pointed out, it's not unusual for a witness to be written a letter saying, please admit service of a subpoena. Is it convenient date and time on your calendar for your deposition? Again, the first time Attorney Schellinger told me or the court that his clients included the management company was at oral argument. And that is significant.
Well, I'm not sure why it's significant. I guess I'll let you finish that sentence, but I'm wondering why that's significant at all. So you're right on target.
It's significant because that's what the trial court focused on in her decision, which I think was wrong. And that's what she says is the appearance of impropriety is my contact with him when he was, quote, Attorney Schellinger's client. The fact of the matter is I wouldn't have had that contact if he had told me such earlier. Not that I think it's innocent contact. But, again,
I didn't see the arguments on the record that it was inappropriate for you to have contact with their client. I'm looking at the notice of motion and motion to disqualify. Is that the oral argument hearing that you're referring to? Is there some other motion that I should be looking at in the transcript?
That is the motion. The oral argument is record 42. The court's decision is record 31.
And that oral argument is on the motion to disqualify. Is
correct.
That correct?
Correct?
And this motion to disqualify sets forth the Foster has a longstanding attorney-client relationship with the Kramer Law Firm. Kramer Law Firm has advised them in a variety of personal and business matters, et cetera, et cetera. There's nothing that I garner from this motion that focuses on, hey, Foster is my client, don't talk to them. That's not what this motion is about.
Actually, Your Honor, I should reference, it's not in the motion paperwork. It's in the reply paperwork that was filed the same day as oral argument. And that's where the trial court focused simply on that aspect of it. So I apologize, Your Honor. It's not in his motion paperwork. It's really not in his brief. It's more in his reply brief. And that, I believe, is in the record as R-25. And I believe that was filed the same day as oral argument.
I must have a misconception of the arguments being advanced then. I understood, as I read the briefs, that the argument being advanced is that Foster had a longstanding attorney-client relationship with Kramer. And that's why you look at the SCRs 20.19, which deals with dual client, serial client representation, and the SCR dealing with dual client representation. It was all with regard to Foster's representation by the Kramer Law Firm. I did not see this case advancing in its arguments because, hey, he's the client of your opposing counsel's law firm.
I realize that, Your Honor, but I believe at the oral argument stage, it basically converted to the contact was inappropriate. It was based upon their firm's relationship with this particular key witness that they believe existed, and that's what the trial court focuses on.
Key witness is different than client, so what is it? What is it that I'm supposed to be hearing? That your opposing counsel is asserting that Foster is a key witness of ours, and we have a relationship with him through contract for maintenance of Bishop's Grove, or it's our client, that Foster is our client. What are you saying? I'm missing.
Well, I'm saying both. He is saying they're a witness, and we agree that he's simply a witness. He's not a party, and their company's not a party. But also, he's saying that this witness is my client, and therefore you can't have contact with him. And as a lawyer, I have to abide by that. If I understand, even if a witness is represented by an attorney, I should not have contact with that witness. I should go through the attorney ethically once I'm advised of that. And I think that's what the circuit court found is the appearance of impropriety, and that's what her decision focused on. And I believe that's an error. I believe that should be the substantial relationship. I believe the stringent, it should be a stronger standard. I don't believe that it should be as any doubt ruled in favor of disqualification. I don't believe that should be the standard. And I would point to the Nebraska Cordham case, the State X Rel Walmart Cordham case. I believe that's a much more stringent standard, but it's still the same standard, but they give you factors to consider. Your Honors, I don't believe that there was any substantial similarity test done here, and there wasn't any substantial similarities between this case and the reason for my disqualification. And that's the position, and I'm out of time. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Ebbett.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the Court, Honorable Justices, I am John Ebbett, and I'm here to provide the position of Amicus Legal Action of Wisconsin. And our position is that it would be beneficial for the Court to articulate a standard for the decision of this kind of case that is much more protective of the fundamental constitutional right to go into court and be represented by counsel of one's choice than the standard that was applied here and has been applied standard or standards in other cases. It is our position that the appearance of impropriety or all doubts resolved in favor of disqualification are, to use the Seventh Circuit's term in the Freeman case, weak reeds on which to rest the denial of a right, a constitutional right so fundamental as this right to come into court with the counsel of one's choice. As the court put it in Realco Services versus Holt, these standards serve as substitutes for analysis rather than a guide to it. And in the case of resolving all doubts in favor of disqualification, it's easier to find doubt than to resolve difficult questions of law and ethics. This right to counsel of one's choice is a very fundamental constitutional right. It was deliberately inserted into the Wisconsin Constitution on November 30th, 1846, and it was deliberately protected and retained in the Wisconsin Constitution at the 1977 amendments.
I recognize all of that, read your brief carefully, but I still need a standard. And first tell us what problems you get into or you have as legal action where you think that a high standard is required.
Well, the problems that we would get into are we've had several occasions in the past where opposing counsel have tried to remove us from representing our clients
because
of income ineligibility.
All right, that has nothing to do with this.
No, but the problem is not viewing this constitutional right as sacrosanct and making it easier to remove us from a case because that right is not regarded, and then our clients in particular have no other place to turn.
I understand that. The problem is you've got another interest here, whether you call it a sacrosanct right or not, and that is that once you hire a lawyer, that lawyer has an obligation of privilege. That is, the information I give my lawyer is confidential, right?
Correct.
And then you don't want that lawyer to go and represent somebody else and use that privileged information, right?
Correct.
All right. Now we have the use of a privileged information, and the client is not a party here, but the client could be a party, depending on how you view the liability issues, and is very seriously involved and has to testify, would be subject to testifying in this case. Now, can that lawyer use that, I'm not saying there is privileged communication here, but can that lawyer use that privileged communication against the witness?
Well, it has not been established that privileged communication.
That's right. I accept that. I'm going to now say, let's suppose it is established.
No.
Okay.
That in that case, there is a conflict, assuming it's a similar matter.
The witness, not the
correct,
part.
Correct. But
there's still a client.
If it's being used against the former client, then it's a conflict. But the conflict has been established. It's not the appearance of impropriety.
Okay.
It is impropriety.
Right.
And
all
that's
right.
That's a more rigorous standard that requires more thought, more questioning, more analysis than either the mere appearance of impropriety or all doubts resolved in favor of disqualification.
I agree with you on that at the moment for purposes of argument. So what's your test?
Our test is that the objection has to be raised by the former client, that there must be evidence of a conflict which is clear and convincing. Any doubt as to the existence of a conflict must be resolved against, not in favor of, disqualification, and the mere appearance of impropriety is not sufficient. That was not applied in this case, and that's why we think that counsel should not have been disqualified.
Where did you come up with that four-part test?
I used the approach in Freeman that counsel should not be disqualified unless it's absolutely necessary and the disqualification is a drastic measure. I used that approach. I formulated a standard that I thought would protect the constitutional right more closely. It's not the only standard that can be applied. I'm just proffering it as an example of a standard that's rigorous, that's protective of the constitutional right, and it requires much more analysis than appearance of impropriety.
Thank you, Mr. Hillary.
May I ask one?
Justice Prosser.
The court participated in extensive discussion revising the Code of Professional Responsibility a couple of years ago. And, of course, I could have been asleep at some point, but I honestly don't recall reference to this section of the Constitution as really being a factor that needed to be considered in interpreting certain ethical rules. Is this your novel idea, or is this being widely discussed the part of the bar that deals with ethical enforcement?
I think it's a somewhat neglected provision of the state constitution. We've done what we can to discuss it, but I can't state to you that it's being discussed throughout the state bar or in many corners of the legal profession. I think it's been an overlooked provision of the Wisconsin Constitution, but the fact that it's in the Declaration of Rights and has the history I mentioned makes it fundamental.
It's come up to the court in the criminal cases where a defendant wants a particular lawyer to be appointed for him by the state or objects to the court keeping a lawyer. But it's generally come up in federal constitutional provision for a counsel. What's that, six?
Sixth Amendment.
Yeah. Which is in the criminal cases. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to speedy trial and to be informed of the nature, to be confronted with witness, and have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
Yes, and that the Sixth Amendment does not contain the phrase of the defendant's choice. That has been construed to be an implicit part, but the Wisconsin Constitution contains that phrase expressly, and even in those criminal cases, I think that the courts have... I think the formulation is an actual conflict or a serious potential conflict, which is more than mere appearance of impropriety. I have some difficulty with the serious potential conflict language, but I think the test in criminal cases has been much more rigorous than in these cases.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Bradley.
Given the history of this, the wording in the state constitution that you set forth in your brief, I would guess that no other state may have this same wording. Have you had an opportunity to check to see if other state constitutions have piggybacked on Wisconsin and have the same wording?
There are only five other state constitutions that have a clause similar to Article 1, Section 21, Subsection 2, and those are Alabama, Georgia, Michigan, Mississippi, and Utah.
Yeah.
None of them contain the phrase of the suitor's choice.
That's what I'm talking about. Because that's the language that you trace in your brief, and that's the important, I think, pedestal upon which you stand with regard to your argument that those words are in our Constitution.
It is, and that enhances the fundamental nature rather than diminishes it to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ebbett. Mr. Schillinger.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please the Court, Counsel. As the Court of Appeals certification indicated, the precise question is, can disqualification of an attorney in a civil lawsuit be prompted by the attorney's prior representation of a third-party witness who is also an agent of the party moving for disqualification? And I submit to you, yes, when the conduct of that former client is the basis of liability against the moving party, then yes, the moving party can bring a motion to disqualify. Going back to an interesting issue, typically when I'm in these cases, the management company does get sued. The condominium is vicariously liable. And therefore, in my brief to this court, the reason why I submitted the case of Estate Theaters is because the argument came up, which was, gee, you don't have standing to make this argument because the defendant or my prior client or my client is not part of this lawsuit. It's not a party. The court rejected that argument, saying that any member of the bar can bring up a matter that requires this court's attention. One of the reasons why I gave this court the Vernon versus McKibben citation in my brief is because it establishes the inherent power of this court to decide peculiar issues that come before it. And if you look at the language that was specifically used in the Rose K case, the court specifically said the non-client parent can bring up this issue to our attention. Why? Because the court recognizes there are issues that need to be addressed. And in that sense, the court is required to bring up these issues. Does Bishop's Grove have standing? Of course they do. Because under Knight, Foster, the management company, is Bishop's Grove. Under the law, they are one and the same. And in the trial court, I did argue the substantial relationship test, and what pushed the case over the edge was the ongoing relationship that the Kramer firm had with Foster.
Counsel, you cite the Estates Theater case, but when that case was decided, the rule had different language. And in 1972, I think it was subsequently changed, wasn't it, or sometime around that time, after the Estates Theater case, where the language about the obligation of lawyers to report was changed such that the obligation is to report, I think, to something like the Office of Lawyer Regulation, and only in situations dealing with, honesty or trustworthy or fitness to practice, the three categories. I'm not sure I got those right. So the Estate Theaters case, the language upon which you rely is with regard to attorneys has been changed.
But the inherent power of the court still remains the same.
Well, if you want to argue inherent power, you can argue inherent power, but you can't argue Estate Theater, then I don't think.
But here, when you look at Vernon versus McKibben, what the court said in that was that when an issue is brought up, it can be brought up by the court sua sponte, it can be brought up by a member of the bar, it can be brought up by a private citizen. Once it is brought up, it's the court's duty to examine it.
You know, I have one of my concerns about, I'm not sure I want a bright line rule about standing, but as I understand it, a general rule about standing is, I'm hesitant to have every Tom, Dick, Harry, and Henrietta who may not be a party to the lawsuit coming in my court, if I'm a circuit court judge, and saying, oh, judge, on that case versus Smith versus Jones, one of them shouldn't be involved. Well, you know, that don't we, in order to have some meaningful court administration, if nothing else, it just makes sense on the issue of standing that it would not be wide open, that it would be tight, that it would be a general rule of limiting standing That is contrary to your position.
Your Honor, in this case, the rule would be when the non-party is through whom liability is established.
When the non-party is what?
Is through whom liability will be established against the party. Then you have standing because it affects my client's interests, Bishop's Grove, because their agent is who their liability will be derived through. And it is the long-standing relationship that persists in this case that taints this procedure. The condominium association looks at the agent and says, are you telling me your lawyer is suing us? Was the advice they gave you about condominium law and property management correct, or are you deviating from it? That's the implication here. And because of that, there is confidential information that gives the plaintiff unfair advantage against Bishop's Grove and their agent. And under law, they are one and the same.
What does the record show? How long has it been since the Kramer Law Firm represented Foster?
All I can tell you is that when Mr. Foster raised it himself in my telephone conversation, he said the last lawsuit they defended me in was this.
Is this part of the record? What does the record show, if anything?
The record shows, and it's in my original brief, it's in the affidavit, that Mr. Foster raised the issue with me.
Okay, and the timing is what? That's my question.
November 21st. And there is an...
You'll have to stand in front of the microphone so you can be recorded, sir.
I apologize, Your Honor.
No problem.
There's some reference to 15 years or something, if I recall.
There's a 15-year relationship, and my argument before Judge Foster in the trial court was that it's likely to continue. It's in the record that I said that. The relationship is that he will continue using the Kramer firm at some point. There was a question before about the developer, and an issue came up about Reinhard Borner, and a discussion took place regarding that. Well, the property manager is one of the developers, and how Reinhard Borner got onto the condominium documents is quite simple. Whoever is the largest investor gets to choose the counsel for that particular project drafting the documents. But going back to the long-standing relationship, you know, on November 21st, 2008, at Respondent's Appellant, page 101, there's a letter where we discuss the conflict of interest. And I send a letter verifying to Attorney Adringa. Also, we discuss postponing Wayne Foster's deposition. As you know, I am investigating whether or not there is a conflict of interest. I know you do not believe there is one. However, as your courtesy to me, so that I do not have to file an ex parte motion, you agree to postpone his deposition. What's important is his position all along has been, he's not sued. He's not a party. There's no standing. Well, you know what? Yes, there is. Because you're using information from the past, and the interesting thing, I think the fox has already been in the chicken coop. And why do I say that? When you look at Mr. Andringa's affidavit pre-suit, he talks to the adjuster, and after he talks to the adjuster, he says the adjuster doesn't know what she's talking about, and he then talks to the property manager.
Counselor, I want to go back to the court's decision, which was based on the appearance of a conflict of interest. And just so I'm sure I'm clear on the facts, you're not maintaining that the Foster Group is a, quote, employee of the defendant, but rather an independent contractor for the defendant, correct?
Not only an independent contractor, but their exclusive agent pursuant to that management contract.
I'm more interested in your assertions that somehow they are your client when they are not an employee. That's a new concept to me.
Under the insurance policy, every time I've represented a condominium association and a management company, they have always been my insureds under the policy and therefore my client.
Okay, they may have been your insureds under the policy, and I understand that. So you're looking at it, even though they're not a name party, because if they're negligent, the insurance company is going to have to pony up, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you would have to pay for their negligence, even if somehow they were negligent, but the condominium association was not negligent.
Correct.
And did you give notice to anyone that they were, that you were representing the Foster Group?
I thought my letters in July were clear.
Well, had you already provided the insurance policy at that time?
The request to admit, Your Honor, went out on June 11th, 2008, and therefore on the cover sheet where it would have said that it was in care of Wayne Foster, I think.
Well, when was that provided to opposing counsel that they were an insured? And you obviously are the attorney for the insurance company, so.
Yes. The defendant's first request for admissions of the policy limit and the policy provisions mm-hmm. was sent on June 11th, 2008.
Okay, so you sent them the policy on June 11th, 2008?
Pursuant to the request to admit, which is the respondent's appendix.
All right, and when was the conversation that you objected to?
The conversation that was objected to was a conversation between plaintiff and the management company, which was described in the July 22nd, 2008 letter of mine.
Okay, but when did it occur? I understand the date of your letter. When did the contact between opposing counsel and the Foster Group occur?
There was contact, number one, pre-suit. There was contact on January of 2009 when he sends a letter directly to Mr. Foster saying, I have rescheduled your deposition. That's respondents. Appendix page 175, he also says, if you have any other concerns, please do not hesitate to contact me. By this time, I think it's apparent that this is my client.
Okay, so you provided the policy June 11th, 2008.
Correct.
And the conversation you're objecting to is not certainly the pre-suit contact.
No, but I think that shows
the contact that occurred in January of 2009.
There is a letter that goes to Mr. Foster from Mr. Adringa in 2009, correct?
Okay. All right.
How can you object to that in your July 22nd, 2008 letter? I mean, something isn't squaring up here. You said there was contact pre-suit, but you're not talking about is that the objected to conversation, the pre-suit conversation?
It is all of it. It shows an ongoing relationship that has not ended with a client.
Okay.
It shows a familiarity, Your Honor.
Okay, so there's pre-suit conversation. Once the suit has been filed, other than conversation that occurred in January of 2009, I said conversation, you said contact. That was a letter regarding a deposition that was sent. So other than that, what other contact or conversation occurred that was the subject of your letter complaining of contact on July 22nd, 2008. What are we talking about?
Sure. The plaintiff contacted Mr. Foster asking for evidence and wanted to know where a gutter was. And Mr. Foster eventually contacts me saying, the plaintiff is asking for this. What? So I send this letter to Mr. Andringa advising him, don't contact my clients.
You know what's going on here, and I don't have it figured out, but I think there is something that's involved in this analysis with our direct action statute. You know, we talk about named, talk about not a party, not a party, and I say to myself, I don't care who's a party, because no one has to be a party in this action because of a direct action statute. And I just don't have it quite, no one in the briefs talks about the implication of the direct action statute and what import, if any, it should have in the analysis. And I don't have it figured out, but there's something going on here that intertwines with the direct action statute so that these arguments about named party are may take a different twist.
Your Honor, that's a very interesting point. I did not consider it. But when you look at it, they didn't even have to name Bishop's Grove. They could have just named State Farm.
That's right. But so big deal. That's the problem I have. So big deal.
So whether they're named or not isn't what the court looks at. It's whether or not they could have been sued and if they are a former client. And that's the point.
I'm not sure. Go ahead, Chief.
Could they have been sued? I started out the questioning, as did Justice Bradley, with could the Foster Group have been sued here as a party?
Yes.
You can sue anybody. Right. I mean, I could have been sued in the case, but we would have gotten a quick dismissal of that, right?
You're exactly correct, Your Honor.
But was there some merit, arguable merit, in suing Foster Group here?
Yes, because
on what basis?
Because they are one and the same, number one, with Bishop's Grove.
No, they're not.
They are the same party.
They're two separate entities.
They are, but under the law, they're the same. The actions of the agent is imputed to Bishop's Grove. If they had sued the management company, Your Honor, and the management company failed to inspect the property, or if they had their own people who were supposed to have repaired that gutter and had notice of it, that's the negligence under which the condominium would be held responsible. And under a direct action statute, State Farm would also be liable because they were co-insured.
Well, it was a discussion whether this is an agent or an independent contractor. You're not liable for the negligence of your independent contractor ordinarily, right?
Not necessarily true.
That's right. That comes under ordinarily. Not necessarily true. That's why Mr. Andringer kept saying it's non-delegable, it's non-delegable. Then whoever is taking charge, whether it's an agent or independent contractor, you'd be liable. But so the issue really is, from my perspective, it's not whether it is a party who is making the claim for revealing client confidences. It's the relation. I think the two questions in this case are interrelated. That is, if there's a relationship, substantial relationship between the nature of the suit and the former representation, then I would think that the non-client can raise it. If there's no relationship, then with the present suit.
And I would
suppose
agree.
That the firm had represented Mr. Foster in violating the leash law in Waukesha.
We wouldn't be here.
Wouldn't be here because there's absolutely no relationship.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so what's the matter with a rule that says, and I'm getting this from In Re Yon Processing Litigation 530 Federal 2nd 83 5th Circuit, says, general rule, courts don't disqualify an attorney on the grounds of conflict of interest unless the former client moves for disqualification, which Foster did not do.
Which the former client. See, no, because
there was an affidavit by Mr.
Correct.
Foster.
And I believe as the agent of Bishop's Grove, that is also gives us Bishop's Grove standing if that becomes the technical issue in this case.
I wonder here if you're mixing up something. You've said before, of course, that the agent may act for the principal. Now, that's kind of black-letter law oftentimes. But you are, in your argument, really saying the principal here may act for the agent. The principal here, Bishop's Grove, may assert a privilege or assert a argument for the agent. And I'm not sure with regard to standing that's correct. I'll tell you, I think it's possible that State Farm, under the direct action statute, with an insured under the policy being the Foster Group, would have standing to move for disqualification. I think that's possible. I think that Bishop's Grove likely would adhere to the analysis would adhere to the general rule that you wouldn't have standing. You're positing that the principal may act for the agent, and I don't know where you find that law. The converse is very true.
Well,
agent
wait,
may act for the
Your
principal.
Honor, if we look at some of the federal cases cited, even if we look at the Westinghouse case that has been cited, it was a non-client that moved the court, and the court looked at it and said, yes, confidences were passed, and therefore that's the reason for the disqualification. You got to be able to look beyond. Sometimes you have to be able to look beyond the who's bringing it, as long as it's a party to the lawsuit, and that party has a direct detrimental impact on this. Here's you know, Your Honor, I understand what you're saying.
Sorry. I just want to note here, I think that as I read the motion, although it's not clear, it looks like just Bishop Grove is making this motion to disqualify.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would amend that so that it's also State Farm. But regardless.
It doesn't say that, though.
I would
represent
amend
it. State Farm.
Yes, I do. But, Your Honor, I guess going back to the point, State Farm's got the right to do it. I think Mr. Foster, who is the agent, has the right to utilize Bishop's Grove to do it. That's what his affidavit is. It's the act of the agent is also the act of Bishop's Grove. But when you talk about standing, and the important part of this case is what was phrased in the certification. This isn't just an ordinary witness. This is who liability is derived through. Because of that, I think Bishop's Grove, too, has the standing because its liability is via its agent. The agent's liability is implicated in this lawsuit. And the substantial relationship that I argued in the trial court, in those briefs, is that these gentlemen were the ones who advised Foster on how to manage the property, how to do condominium.
I want to get over this standing argument. We've spent most of your time on that. Just say for purposes of argument, I agree, they're standing. I'm going to talk about whether or not there should have been a disqualification here, okay?
All right.
And as I read the circuit court's decision, it sounds to me like this disqualification may have been a sanction for a letter contract by the Foster Group after you'd provided the insurance policy. Do you think that's correct?
No.
Okay, why not?
Because, Your Honor, I believe in the faith of not only our trial courts, but co-counsel. Co-counsel has represented this court that he did not understand or realize who my clients are. I'm not here for.
Well, what is this appearance of impropriety? To me, the standard is, even if this was a party, the standard is substantially related matter.
That's
okay,
right.
Okay, so the trial court did not apply that standard as I read the trial court's decision. So I'm trying to figure out why she decided what she decided, given what she said and given what you said.
Because she took into account what I said, took into account the brief, which did argue substantial relationship.
She didn't say a word about it in her decision.
That's correct. Because what pushed her over the top was the ongoing relationship. That substantial relationship to the past continues with the familiarity in the present, which is tainting the process of this lawsuit. They are taking unfair advantage of my client via the agent. Both, you can witness that in the pre-suit conversation where Mr. Foster goes to the adjuster to explain who's responsible.
I understand all of that, Counselor, but you know, in the small world of businesses that operate condominiums and develop condominiums. It gets to be a brotherhood. Everybody knows everybody. And just because someone worked for this particular condo association and plaintiff's counsel happened to know them, as long as they were not an employee of the corporation, it's just some guy they know in the business. So unless you can show that it's substantially related, the past representation, I don't know how you get where you want to go if you're going to push aside the trial court's determination that it was there was an appearance of impropriety. I mean, you're arguing one thing and she's saying something else. I understood the test as what was argued in the briefs, not what the trial court verbally applied. So, you know, if you're going to say, I mean, it's only improper once they have the insurance policy. Otherwise, it's just a guy they know. He's not your employee. There's no, I mean, in lawsuits, people talk to people all the time. But once you've provided the policy and they're a named insured, I can get on the same page you're on. But I can't get there until they know they're a named insured. I can't. So, you know, if we're going to just put aside now, there's no appearance of impropriety after the notice, then I want to go back and talk about where's the substantial relationship
in
the two representations.
This is a 15-year relationship. It's not some guy. It is a client. It is a client that they have and are likely to use again. They use that client, Your Honor, in pre-suit litigation to convince the adjuster that they are responsible.
You know, if
that's unfair.
If they were not a named insured, just say you didn't have the agent as a named insured in your policy. What gripe do you have with their contacting this particular person? Just say they weren't a named insured.
They're an agent who we derive liability. That's what is the impact, Your Honor. And they're using an unfair advantage, even in the pre-suit, based upon their relationship.
You know, oftentimes people have relationships that give them information. I mean, you're all operating in the same business community here.
But lawyers are held to a different standard. There are confidentialities that must be kept.
Once they know that they are your client, I'm on your page.
No.
Well, they knew you were the client in June, right?
Yep, June 11th, according to what you told me.
Now, here's my problem on substantial relationship. They're a client, but as I read the affidavit, they're a client on the development end, not on the management end. So I can be a client on one business and not another. Right? Everything in the affidavit smells to me that the Kramer law firm represented Foster in developing condos, not the management thereof after development.
I don't agree with that.
That's fine. That's why I'm asking you this question. And the other thing is the judge took no testimony.
Yes.
And these affidavits are one or two pages long, and they are very bare-boned as I read it. So I don't know how I can decide whether there's a substantial relationship.
You know, Your Honor, part of the problem is when you do the research, you find out that this court has said, if you think there's disqualification, you should not examine the reasons for the disqualification or disclose those confidences. Well, if this court isn't supposed to, how could I have inquired of Mr. Foster to get all the facts that I needed? Now, as it comes down to the issue of affidavits or evidentiary hearing, I think, you know, once again, I have faith in the trial courts, I have faith in this bench. They can utilize whatever tools they want to decide an issue. Had Mr. Andringa wanted an evidentiary hearing, he could have asked for it. I could have asked for it. The court could have. The court has all kinds of tools that are available to them. But I believe that the courts in general exercise their discretions appropriately, and I believe the court exercised its discretion appropriately in this case, taking into account not only the briefs, but the arguments.
Well, you know what? Appropriate exercise of discretion tells the reviewing court what law you relied on and what facts you relied on. And if the law she relied on was that it was – an appearance of impropriety, to me, that's the wrong standard.
Your Honor, I believe the result was correct. And I believe that there is a substantial relationship back to the prior representations and over the 15 years, and that ongoing relationship has impacted and will impact this case, and it taints and is unfair.
Suppose they were neighbors, Mr. Andringa and Mr. Foster are neighbors, close friends, share snow plows and other equipment, and aren't client relationship. Then you wouldn't have any problem, right?
If there was no attorney-client relationship, well, then we would not be here, because there is no attorney-client.
So now I'm going to posit that Mr. Andringa has firm has represented them in just development, not management. And they're good friends.
I believe, well.
Is that a substantial relationship in your mind?
It might not. It really depends upon a lot more, but.
Right. So then I'd have to know in what other capacities the Kramer firm represented Foster, right?
If it's just development, yes.
Well, if it's beyond development, I have to know roughly that it was beyond development. All I have to know is that it related to management, right? There's a reference in Foster's affidavit that he was sued on some matter. It doesn't say what.
True.
So I don't know if it's development or.
And I did not go into it, Your Honor. When Mr. Foster raised the issue with me, that's when I started researching the issue.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Sheldon.
Thank you.
Mr. Andringa.
Thank you, Your Honors. I hope to be less than 5 minutes. Two things. First of all, I'm not going to talk about standing anymore. I believe that's been addressed. The substantial relation test requires an analysis of what this case is about, a slip and fall on common area at Bishop's Grove, compared to the prior representation by our firm. I would point out two things. If you look at the affidavit of Mr. Foster, he does not object to our firm's representation. That is implied through counsel, but nowhere in his affidavit does he indicate, and I object to the law firm Kern, Multoff and Hammes, representing the plaintiffs in this case. Further, he points out that they do management and development, etc., but he never points out that anything of the Kramer firm related to management issues at any condominium that he manages. Attorney Plowshine's affidavit, I could grab the recital of the record, but Attorney Plowshine's affidavit makes it clear we haven't. The substantial relation test isn't met, and the trial court never even addressed it. She got so caught up in the hint of impropriety, which I dispute, by the way, but she got so caught up in that, she didn't even get to the substantial relationship test. I implore the court to review the Nebraska case, the Walmart versus Cordham. It sets forth a real good analysis of what you should look for to determine substantial relationship. And I think that, posited with Attorney Ebbett's standard on page 7 of his brief, will really assist the court in establishing a more clear standard. You know, it's interesting that if I had been a lawyer or Attorney Plowshine had been a lawyer and brought this client over, we could build the proverbial Chinese wall and we wouldn't be here with respect to that. But in a case where I never knew Wayne Foster, and I do want to make that clear on the record, I didn't know when I was talking to Wayne Foster that I was talking to a client of this firm, and I believe I've stated that in my affidavit. But more important, and my last point, I received a request for admissions. It's Exhibit 1. Respondent's Appendix, page 107. It's addressed to my attention, sending to me State Farm and Bishop's Grove's first request for admission. Two requests. Admit that attaches a policy and admit that policy has $1 million of liability limits. You look at the deck page. The deck page indicates that the insured is Bishop's Grove.
Doesn't the deck page have Foster Group on it? Bishop's Grove in care of Foster Group?
Correct. It's sending it to Foster Group, but it doesn't identify Foster Group as an additional insured.
It may not be a named insured, but it's an insured under the terms of the policy.
It's an important distinction, Your Honor. And what I'd like to just point out, and lastly, and then I'll sit down, in order to address Judge Rogan's accurate question with regard to this. This gets sent to me. It asks two questions. Is this a copy of the policy? Technically, none of the lawyers necessarily know that, but we know that if they bring in somebody at the time of trial, you're going to admit the policy because of liability limits. And there's $1 million here. That's why you admit it, so that we don't have to deal with an extra witness. It doesn't identify them in the deck page as being an additional insured. On top of that, it's in the minutia of the policy that any management company, and at that time, while I know they're a management company, I didn't read the entire policy in order to answer these requests for admissions to determine that sometime later he's going to accuse me of having contact with a client. I want it clear there's no ethical issue here. I didn't try to have contact because I have some special relationship with somebody. And that fact's important because it goes to my integrity. Never, never. I wouldn't do it. But there's no substantial relationship test to be met here.
I need some information, which has nothing to do with anyone's integrity. If this is a corporation and we were not with a management company, but the janitor employed by Bishop's Grove condo, could you go talk to the janitor without a lawyer? Without the lawyer on the other side?
I would not. If he's an employee of the association, no. I wouldn't have contact with anybody on the board. And I didn't. Now, I could pre-suit, and I had no contact with Mr. Foster other than sending him the letter because I had done it I understood that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I appreciate the court's patience and time.
The court appreciates you and Mr. Schillinger coming and Mr. Ebbett coming on this novel issue on lawyer ethics. And thank you for your excellent arguments. And thank Mr. Ebbett for raising the Constitution. It also gave me an opportunity to remind me of Article 22. Section 22, I should say, of the Wisconsin Constitution, which I hadn't read for a long time. The blessings of a free government can only be maintained by a firm adherence to justice, moderation, temperance, frugality, and virtue, and by frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. Can't do better than that. That concludes our hearing in 09 AP 688. Susan Foley Chantilly versus Bishop's Grove Condominium Associates, Inc. Where we have an alarm go off at 11 o'clock Wednesdays, the first Wednesday of the month. So the court will take a recess until the alarm goes off. Be prepared for a loud sound. It obviously is either the alarm is late, or our clock is not correct.